Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
In light of recent events in the U.S., race in the media, especially the portrayal of African Americans on television, is on the forefront of many discussions, both personal and public. But what can be said about representations of blacks in other countries, in Great Britain, for instance, and specifically in the early days of the BBC? Welcome to Delmarva Today. Sitting in for Don Rush, I'm Jamila Krumple. Dr. Daryl M. Newton is the author of Paving the Empire Road, BBC Television and Black Britons. Dr. Newton is also the chair and associate professor in Salisbury University's Communication Arts Department. He joins us in the studio today. Hello, Dr. Newton. How are you?
Good morning, Jamila. How are you?
Good. How are you? Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
Great. Well, I guess we should get started. What prompted you to write this book on the BBC's portrayal of Black Britons? And maybe you could explain to us who at that time would be considered a Black Briton.
Surely. Well, a couple things. First of all, it was an offshoot or a part of my dissertation project while in graduate school. I did a second master's in international studies and also in cultural studies and TV studies, and eventually did a PhD, of course, in media studies. Along the way, I made some very dear friends that lived in England. I went over during the spring break, I want to say, of 1992 to spend time with friends there, and we wound up spending a lot of time around folks who worked in the business, that is, actors, producers, writers, and such. And I recall being at a rather enjoyable house party, shall we say, with a group of folks. And the conversation came up about representations of race, especially those of black folks. And I recall someone saying, well, I don't care very much for this program for these reasons or this show for these reasons, but I really love what Americans are doing with black portrayals. And of course, I had some issues with that because I see problems with representations on our television sets here in this country. So I asked the question, well, when you guys think about representations of race on TV, who are your favorites? Who are your favorite performers and actors over the years? And I was blown away to find that all the black Britons I talked to at that gathering, we're talking about 15 or 16 people, all looked to American television for their heroes. So they mentioned the Oprah Winfreys and the Bill Cosbys and Denzel Washingtons and such. But they didn't talk very much about black British actors, despite the fact there have been some very, very highly accomplished black British actors around for a very long time. So that prompted my thoughts, well, gee, what is it about British television that makes them feel the need to look to American TV as opposed to their own television sets? And then prompted, of course, the research question. So from there, I started my research, continued through the grad program. And once the grad program was over and the dissertation was done, I realized I had even more questions to ask, I guess, about certain situations, certain issues. So from there, I started doing more research, more papers, more trips to England, archival research at the BBC archives in Caversham, England, which is just west of London, and lots of other places. And began to understand that the BBC had an onus essentially to inform the British public about all things cultural, including race, but sometimes didn't do quite the job they wished they had and needed to fall back on talking with West Indians themselves about representations of race. Now, when thinking about notions of blackness or about black ideology or black identification, I would argue that here we're talking about those folks who tie into the African diaspora, West Indians, West Africans, African Americans, Afro-Caribbeans of all sorts are all talked about in the book when it comes to issues of blackness. And I'd argue also that many black Britons do indeed feel a kind of connection to each other, a kind of identity, a kind of solidarity in many ways. So the book looks at these folks and what they did, of course, to try and help the BBC tell their stories and to make race relations a bit more easy after the war.
I see. Okay. In the 1940s and 1950s, you would be, and I guess I can make this generality, you would be hard-pressed to find a black actor on U.S. television fronting a show. Mm. But when I was looking at and reading the book in 1957, A Man from the Sun, which was a teleplay, you have a black actor and a or a you know, in a starring role or in a prominent role, comparatively speaking, that's somewhat progressive compared to other countries in the U.S. and things like that. So they were breaking some ground, so to speak. Of course, there were some problems involved with that as far as the sort of broadening of that character or certain, you could say, marginalization of the immigrant experience and the black experience in Britain. What would you say to that, that they were sort of progressive when you look at comparatively what the roles were for blacks in television in America during that time?
Absolutely. A couple of things come into play here. First of all, when considering the representations that we saw in England as compared to the U.S., in the United States, remember that back at that time when television was in its infancy, we're talking 47, 48, there was a concern by many advertisers that programs featuring blacks wouldn't be watched, or that many whites who may have issues with integration or with blacks in general may not watch these TV programs and consequently would not buy the products the advertisers wanted to, of course, try to sell. So because we had this kind of sponsorship basis within commercial television in this country, we were concerned greatly about the idea of losing revenue. In England, the BBC is, of course, a licensed paid service and is commercial free. People pay their taxes or pay a certain fee every year to keep the BBC on the air. The BBC's mandate then, of course, is to try and provide programming for all the people. So as the immigration issue became kind of brought to the forefront, shall we say, after the war, it was necessary then to offer programming that began to look at these sorts of issues, such as A Man from the Sun. The Man from the Sun was a TV program that looked specifically at the experiences of a man named Cleve, a West Indian immigrant coming to England trying to seek fortune after the war. And as many people know, after the war, of course, the West Indies were just economically depleted completely, and also depleted of manpower, because many West Indians came to England, you know, seeking better jobs and better situations and such, including our character Cleve. There's no way that American television would have taken the risk to do something like that at the time. Instead, we saw things like Amos and Andy or like The Beulah Show that were somewhat buffoonish, funny in their own way. And in many ways, because it was a comedy, it did give these folks a chance to kind of strut their stuff and show their abilities as actors. But the problem is, if there are no other sorts of programs to compare to, then the representations of these blacks seem very shallow and very one-dimensional. In England, on the other hand, you saw a range of representations in the 50s, and even going back as early as 52 or 53, in which blacks were featured within certain sorts of programs as part of an ensemble cast. And in one case, they actually televised Othello on British television, featuring an American black actor portraying Othello, and that was something the audiences just adored. It also created some problems, too, as the book talks about, in that many black British actors felt they could have gotten that role as opposed to a black American, which gets to some other issues of Americanization and things like that. But to address your question, really, quite frankly, I think American television was far too concerned with commercial advertising, whereas the Brits didn't have to worry about that, so they took more chances.
Speaking of taking some chances, and I don't want to compare everything to America, but in 67, there was a show that featured a black actor, and he had a white wife as his character with their characters. So that's 67. And then I don't believe that there was an interracial marriage shown on American television until 1975 with the Jeffersons. So comparatively speaking, that 8 years is sort of another indication that different types of relationships or different types of people coming together, I guess, sort of out of necessity to sort of document the British experience or British culture was sort of included when, you know, other types of media were sort of not late in the game, but came later.
Absolutely. In the program you're speaking of, Rainbow City, took place in Birmingham. It featured a black barrister or a lawyer and, of course, his white wife and his in-laws. That show was very remarkable, not only because it pushed the envelope of interracial relationships, but also because it featured this fellow as a guy who wasn't exactly your model citizen, so to speak. He questioned his family's beliefs in him as a lawyer. He questioned his father-in-law's understanding of the interracial relationship he had with his daughter, despite the fact it had gone on for years and they had a child. There's one very pivotal episode in which the father and mother want very much to raise their son in England as opposed to taking the son back to the islands for even just a short visit, whereas the father wants the son to see his black roots, so to speak, and it creates a bit of tension. So the program wasn't afraid to push the envelope and do some really great things. In the book, I also talk about a great episode called Beards and Turbans, in which a white property owner, who's a bit of a slum landlord, runs a building in which some black families live and also an Indian student who had come over to study medicine or something. And consequently, the student goes after the landlord for having him live in some really terrible conditions and asking for more rent. Well, he ultimately has to hire our hero, the barrister, to represent him in court because the landlord refuses to improve things. Well, one of the tenants in the building happens to also be an Irish gentleman who is a very good friend of the white landlord. Well, once it gets down to the actual hearing, the Irishman then chooses to side with the other immigrants and complains about the landlord, much to the landlord's chagrin. He's rather obviously upset because this is his friend. But he sides with the West Indians, with the West Africans, and the Indian student living in the building and criticizes the landlord. So the program was groundbreaking in a lot of different ways. It looked not just at black and white issues, but also the ones that fall in between the cracks, so to speak, those gray areas, and looked at issues that address the immigrant experience in general. So it was very, very positive in that way. American TV wouldn't get close to anything like that at that time. And as you may know, of course, the first interracial kiss was a couple of years before that on Star Trek with, of course, William Shatner and with Nichelle Nichols, I should say, who played Uhura. Well, British television had their first interracial kiss in 1962 on a program called Emergency War 10, in which a white doctor kissed a black female doctor, and audiences went ballistic. Really? They really did. Yeah, lots of letters. The network was very unhappy about the idea, too, and eventually killed the character off as opposed to allowing the relationship to develop. Wow. So saying that to say that, the Brits weren't all that progressive. Mm-hmm. They had their issues, too.
Right. Can you speak to what you term the color divide that was, I guess, maybe not recognized by all people in the country, but nonetheless was very present and functioned and operated in several different ways? And maybe an example of that is when it became, I guess, more present and volatile during the riots in 1958.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Can you speak to that? Well, the color divide was essentially the notion that these folks coming over after the war from the West Indies, and we're talking about Jamaica, the Leeward Islands, lots of other locations as well, they didn't come in masse. That is, it wasn't like hundreds and thousands of people, but just tens of thousands at a time, and that increased year after year. Many white Britons, especially those of a lower income status, called Teddy Boys, that was a nickname they gave themselves, had real issues with the fact that a lot of these folks were moving into their neighborhoods, neighborhoods that were impoverished, poor neighborhoods and such. And there's also the threat, supposedly, that these folks were going to take their jobs. And never is racism more inherent and more obvious than when economics come into play. So the fact that these guys may come in and take their positions, which, of course, wasn't really the case, that was a fallacy. There was lots and lots of jobs rebuilding England after the war, thanks to the Marshall Plan and other sorts of financial backings. They still had issues with the fact that these guys were there, issues with the fact these guys were dating their women, they were going to their restaurants and going places that they had frequented in the past. So this divide came when many whites simply would not allow blacks to live in certain areas for fear, not so much that blacks would bring the neighborhoods down, but fear that there would be reprisals, there would be anger, there would be fights. In fact, one of the things I talk about in the book was a TV program that was offered in the 50s that took a look at race and looked at race from a racial, much more from a scientific perspective. And audiences, when they responded, were really unhappy with the program. They wanted to hear less about sort of like eugenics and less about genetic comparisons and much more about what do I do if I'm running to a black chap and a bunch of Teddy Boys come by my house and want to stone my windows, then what do I do? Right. If I turn these guys away who are decent people, it makes me look bad, but if I let them move in, the rest of my tenants will move out. You know, these sorts of issues were things that were talked about, and that just made the divide even worse. I mean, the chasm even wider.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. One of the things that I was struck by in that section talking about some of the riots in Liverpool and Birmingham mm-hmm. is that the British police were taking cues from what they had seen an American television, I guess BBC was pulling images and stories mm-hmm. about the riots in the South here mm-hmm. and how the police were, I guess, in their minds, quelling the crowds with hoses. Mm-hmm. And the British police started adopting one of those methods to sort of, I guess, what they felt was controlling the crowds or something like that. Mm-hmm. It just speaks to the power of media that you can be in a different country and see these images and you know, take what someone else is doing for harm and adopt it yourself.
Oh, absolutely. The populace also did a lot of that. In fact, there's a couple Teddy Boys who went after one young black man in one part of, I want to say, London, and chased him into a greengrocer's, that is a supermarket, and wouldn't let him come out for fear of, like, being beaten to death. And I recall the young man supposedly told the press when he was interviewed, well, we're getting our cue from what we saw in Little Rock. We're teaching blacks here like blacks in America have been taught and things like that. So the power of media was present for the police and for the populace as well. And the police there also, when trying to quell some of these riots, they often would turn the entire notion to not a matter of race, but a matter of trying to restore law and order and trying to deal with hooligans. The idea that these young men who would fight on the streets, whether black or white or whatever, should be locked up because they're hooligans and they're causing problems and they're carrying what are called flick knives or switchblades to harm each other. But it's funny to find that overwhelmingly there were more young white men arrested for these sorts of activities than young black men. Mm. But the young black men who involved themselves in these sorts of activities would be asked to move out of their rooming houses, to move out of their communities. They might lose their jobs. They may lose their status at work and things like that. So they paid a higher price despite the fact their involvement in these sorts of riots and upheavals was lessened or was less than, let's say, some of their white counterparts.
Hmm. So, and I guess we should talk about how during that time, a very aggressive, volatile time in British history, how the BBC dealt with that or how they spoke about that, how they documented those problems that the country was experiencing at the time.
Mm-hmm. Lots of programs began to come along, I'd say probably in about the mid-50s, programs that dealt with race. There's a great series that was offered by BBC called A Question of Color, part of a series of programs run by the Special Inquiry Series. And A Question of Color looked at blacks who moved to Birmingham, how they were faring, how they were getting by, what was going on. It looked at issues of racial prejudice, rooming houses, landladies turning blacks away, problems with getting jobs and things like that. Then they returned some years later to see how some of these black folks were faring after a period of time and found that some were doing better, and found that the populace was indeed accepting these black immigrants much more so than ever before. However, when you actually spoke with some of the blacks themselves about their circumstances, they weren't very happy. So this kind of, if not utopian, this kind of notion of this greatly improved sort of race relations circumstance really wasn't the case. That's why later on, I'd say probably as early as maybe 1965, the BBC began to poll black students and black community activists much more so about their feelings about what the BBC was doing. The general feeling, for example, at this one conference is talked about in one of the chapters in 1965 with Director General Hugh Green. He met with a bunch of activists from the West Indian community as well as the Indian community in two separate meetings to ask them how we can help you. And one of the major criticisms of many of the black Britons that attended the conference was that you guys are offering up programs that tend to set us aside as something unusual, as opposed to talking about ways to assimilate us or integrate us all. Mm-hmm. Don't look at issues of difference. Look at issues of similarity. And that's where the BBC, I think, failed in many ways in the 50s and 60s and beyond that. And thanks in large part to these West Indian activists and students who spoke up about this, even going back to like the late 30s when being interviewed for radio, they made it very clear that we are having a tough time, but we have a tougher time when you guys highlight us as a problem or make us seem as though somehow we're creating these circumstances. Very seldom are you looking at the white Britons who are causing the problems for us. Mm. And that became, of course, a kind of discourse that carried forward.
Okay. Maybe this would be a good time to have you read a passage of the book on page 16, talking about how West Indians sort of are attempting to assimilate into the culture and their sort of issues and problems with that. And we can talk about it after you read the passage.
Well, surely. On page 16, the first chapter, there's a humorist called A.E.T. Henry, a West Indian fellow who was well known and well loved at the time. He was interviewed by BBC Radio about his experiences living in England as a West Indian. And he said this, "Well, one thing I think that will interest West Indians is what the attitude of the English people as a whole. How do they take to strangers? After all, West Indians are coming over here in increasing numbers, and they're likely to know what sort of person they're going to meet and how they're going to be treated." And in many ways, that was the bottom line, Jamela. It really was. So many West Indians wanted so much to have the opportunity to find out from the BBC what to expect once they did immigrate to the country, what was going to take place. Could I find a place to live? Will I get a job? Will people mistreat me? You know, what's the weather like there? What kind of clothing do I need? And things like that. Mm-hmm. And that was very important for, of course, the media to provide that sort of information.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that it's fair to say that the BBC was trying to sort of bridge that cultural divide between the immigrants coming in and crafting them or framing them as sort of this new British citizen, emphasizing their Britishness or their Englishness and their desire to assimilate into the culture to sort of calm fears that white Britons may have about this new British citizen or this other that might be coming in, and some of the fears and ideas, negative ideas that might come with that.
Mm-hmm. They surely did. Early on, they did. Some of the earliest images that Britain saw of West Indians was from a TV program called Television Newsreel, where British Pathé would send newsreel crews out to shoot various events to show in movie theaters. The BBC then began to offer that up as a TV program because newsreels are so very popular from various places. But there was one sequence of West Indians arriving on the Empire Windrush in which they were interviewed about the reasons for coming to England. And the voiceover makes it clear that these folks are being welcomed here. They're British citizens like the rest of us. They're part of the Commonwealth. They have paid their dues in the war. They've done the right thing. They are indeed citizens. Well, that was the case, and that was a discourse early on. Then when immigration numbers increased, then suddenly became the Jamaican problem. It became an issue with all these blacks coming over looking for work, and what do we do about all these people, and how can we possibly keep them all employed? Then, of course, when racism, as they call their racialism, began, then there became the issue overall of, oh my goodness, now more problems are being caused by their arrival. So they became kind of framed as problematic, as these individuals that were indeed, if not responsible for the problems, causing the problems indirectly. And that caused, of course, lots of folks to say, well, gee, what do we do about this? Are there too many of them here? What should we do? And eventually, all sorts of acts were passed by Parliament and other things were discussed to quell the number of immigrants coming into the country.
Mm. Okay. Was it a role of the BBC or one of their interests to sort of educate white Britons about Caribbean culture or West Indian culture, Jamaican culture, things like that? Or were they primarily emphasizing their new adopted culture being British citizens?
I believe they tried in many ways to normalize that aspect of their culture. But as you suggested earlier about the notion of othering, unfortunately, far too often, West Indians had been othered originally within British discourses as this kind of island place that you go to for a vacation, then you come home to England, or you spend time there for a short time, then come back, or you go there to go native, so to speak, then return. However, when those individuals were now living down the street or across town, it changed everything. So no matter how much the BBC tried to normalize, quote-unquote, these individuals, there were already these kind of historical discourses that othered them and made them seem foreign and made them seem unusual. Mm-hmm. So it took time for Britons to come to accept them and understand them in that way. Even now, when you talk to some Americans about British culture, they don't think about blacks as being part of that culture. They think about Downton Abbey mm-hmm. and upstairs, downstairs, right. and things along those lines, when indeed blacks have been in England since the 15th century. Mm-hmm. So that kind of change in identity is something that has taken a very long time.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I would ask, who were some of the producers in BBC's ranks that were in charge of sort of writing these stories when it came time for dramas to dramas featuring blacks to get on the air, mm-hmm. and even in some of the documentaries, because as we know, who the producers are, they hold the power in mm-hmm. disseminating these images and stories. So were there any black producers, black writers? You mentioned some black actors in the beginning, who were sort of in charge of shaping perceptions of black Britons?
For television, not quite so much. Not until probably about the 1980s. When going back to the 40s and 50s, on television, the writers were primarily white. There's a guy by the name of John Elliott who has been just heralded as this kind of father of the notion of equality among the immigrating masses and such. And he's the guy that wrote A Man from the Sun about, of course, the West Indian fellow Cleve coming to live in England. But again, as a white Briton, when I've listened to him speak, and I've had a chance to meet him, he's a brilliant gentleman when he was around, really great guy, but there was always this kind of very paternal perspective, okay, in that he always kind of stepped up to say, well, gee, we have to tell their stories for them. We have to speak for them. When it came to black producers, we're looking primarily at people like Kenneth the Black and Ed Una Marson. We're thinking about those individuals, and they're talking on radio primarily, or working with radio way back in. Probably we're talking late 40s, early 50s. Recently, not very much.
Okay. Any indication of how the book has been received by British reviewers?
The stuff I've read so far has been very, very positive. I've had a chance to read three reviews thus far. There are folks who feel as though it's something that needed to be said. There's lots and lots of books on British history, but very, very few have done this, if any, before. So I feel like I'm kind of cutting some new ground here.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. Well, it was a pleasure to be speaking with you today, especially on this somewhat original topic, especially for American audiences and myself. So,
well, thank you.
Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Dr. Daryl M. Newton, author of Paving the Empire Road, the BBC Television and Black Britons, was our in-studio guest today. I'm Jamila Crumple. Thank you for joining us on Delmarva Today. Until next time.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Our volunteer producers are Penny Hartman, Kathleen Grout, and Jim White. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.